Support for Louisiana Eats comes from Zatarain's Hot Sauce, specially blended for poor boys, red beans and rice, jambalaya, and all of your favorite Louisiana Eats. From our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Does your daily household feeding routine include more than just two-legged creatures? According to the latest statistics, 68% of American households, or about 85 million, nearly 7 out of 10, all count a furry friend as part of the family. So on this week, round up the whole family, including your pet, for a special edition of Louisiana Eats designed just for them. We begin at the Audubon Zoo, where zookeepers are responsible for the care and feeding of the city's most exotic pets. Wait till you meet Gary the Garfish. Then, we'll take off on a bar crawl with Whitey Bulger, the beloved dog of our producer, Reggie Morris. Whitey is renowned across the city, at watering holes, where he occupies his own bar stool, and always adds much to the conversation. Then, author Brandon Schultz joins us with advice on cooking for two. That's your dog, or cat, and you. So round up the whole family, it's Yappy Hour on this week's Louisiana Eats. Whether you're a lifelong New Orleanian or a newcomer, the Audubon Zoo is likely to hold a special spot in your heart. So a visit with the zoo's residents feels like a homecoming of sorts. The Louisiana Eats crew packed up our gear and went on an expedition to the zoo. We found this sense of family particularly present with the Audubon zookeepers, who forge a nurturing connection with each animal they care for, most of all at mealtime.
My name is Liz Wilson. I'm the curator of Louisiana Swamp and Jaguar Jungle.
My name is Dominique Fletus, and I'm the assistant curator of the Louisiana Swamp and Jaguar Jungle.
We were invited to join the zookeepers as they prepared special meals for the residents before making their daily rounds. Liz and Dominique began by explaining how the animals' feeding schedule works.
It's a little bit varied, so the mammals get fed every day. But a lot of our reptiles might eat once a week, like some of our snakes might eat a mouse like once a week, twice a week. Our gators tend to eat 2 to 3 times a week, depending on how big they are, how much we're wanting them to grow. But the majority of the animals, so all your big mammals, are getting at least one diet a day, if not 2 or 3. So down at the bottom, we have crocodilian biscuits.
Crocodilian biscuits?
Yeah, now, so they're biscuits for our gators. In the past, we fed a lot of big meat products or chicken or even nutria, and they'll still get that occasionally, but mostly they're getting these special crocodilian biscuits, which is their full diet all in one, but it makes it a little bit easier for training.
Well, that's so interesting because it's my observation that the alligators will eat just about anything that moves, including us. So I'm surprised you can get them to perform for a crocodile biscuit.
They do. They actually do really well. Right now we have them coming up in station training, so they'll go to certain spots in the exhibit. And because those biscuits make a little plop at the top of the water when they hit the top of the water, that attracts their attention. And because they can kind of sense the ripples, they know exactly where that food is and they can get a good snap on it.
That's great. Well, let's go see what's coming along the way. First up on the tour, those adorable Audubon otters.
They absolutely love crawfish season. We usually bring in a couple sacks of live crawfish, or sometimes people go out and catch live blue crab, and we'll give it to them as enrichment. So the otters, of course, love their fish. They get a variety. They get catfish fillets, rainbow trout, mackerel. They also get some meatballs. They love hard-boiled eggs. It's something
really?
They really like to tear into. But their favorite is when they can get a live crawfish or crab or occasionally like a sunfish. So you'll notice they'll kind of grab them in their mouth to take them to where they want to go, and then grab them with their little hands. And because of the webbing, they really encapsulate that crawfish so it can't get out. And as soon as they take a couple chomps, it's not going anywhere.
It's amazing. At one time, the otter population was a little threatened because of their fur, wasn't it?
It was. It's actually due to one man down here in Louisiana, a little outside of Houma. He's in Ontario, named Leroy Savant, who started the Bayou Otter Farm. He actually invented a leg hole trap that didn't harm the otters and would work with trappers that he trusted to trap live otters and bring them back to this facility he put together. And there were whole live otters. They weren't harmed at all. But he would put together groups of, 1,000, 2,000 and actually help repopulate Illinois or, Missouri, where they had lost their otter population because of fur hunting. And all because he noticed, hey, while we're trying to trap muskrats or nutria, we're also bycatching otters, and people were okay with it because the fur was also valuable. But he actually, for many, many years until he passed away, ran the Bayou Otter Farm and actually helped get our otter population back to where it is. Not only here, but took our subspecies and helped spread it throughout the United States to get the rest of the population up.
What is, in Louisiana, the otter's native habitat like?
So here in Louisiana, you'll actually see otters almost all the way down to the coast. As long as they have a freshwater source for drinking, they will go into brackish to slightly salty water to catch food. So, we've seen otters that have come through here that have come from Grand Isle, and otters that have come, even from central Louisiana, but usually somewhere around like the Pearl River is a perfect area for them. You got a nice river, moving body of water, a good population of food for them to eat, and a nice safe habitat for them to have their home in.
Thank you for taking us to the otter snack time.
No problem.
Who are we going to go see next?
Yeah, maybe hit up the raccoon exhibit?
Let's go see the raccoon. They are adorable. They are so sweet.
Aaron was feeding these guys every 2 hours initially, round the clock. And we've now gotten down to feeding every 5 or so hours. But these guys, when they're young, take a lot of work. And
how do you do that around the clock?
No sleep.
Oh.
Because by the time you're finishing up the last baby raccoon, you're heating the milk up for the next session.
Do you name them?
We do name them, but we haven't named them yet. Right now, they're going by the color of their nails. So we paint them. So this is blue, and we have an orange and unpainted. We tend to be a superstition where you don't name the babies until they're much older, because you don't want to name them, because when they are this young, they may not thrive. It's just like, any other large litter of animals, one or two may not be strong enough to make it. And so you never really name them until you know that they're going to make it.
When do you introduce solid food to the babies?
At about 8 weeks. So they're a little over six. They'll be 7 weeks on Friday. And so we're going to start doing some more introductions. We've already added baby food and rice cereal to their formula to make it a little bit more thick.
Just like with a real baby.
But then we'll start adding some things like mashed bananas and small cut up fruit and things like that.
Well, I can tell from all of that feeding that you've been doing that this little fella is very fond of you.
I'm fond of him too, so it works out.
Most of my neighbors know I work at the zoo, so if they see me with any kind of like pet carrier coming out of my car, it's draped with a towel, and they're always kind of looking to see what it might be.
Okay, we've got a really big question for you. We're standing here at the snake bite alarm. Tell us about the snake bite alarm. Does it get much use?
It doesn't, and we're really thankful for that. So the snake bite alarm is activated if one of our venomous snake handlers has been bit. That will activate the emergency protocols to take action and get that person treated. We do test it, but we don't, we hope to never have to use it. But we have safety protocols set up for all of our dangerous animals. Whenever our venomous trained handlers are in the building and they pull out the venomous snakes, we lock down all the doors, do an all call for all staff, and have backup in here, and just in case something does happen. But we're really fortunate that we haven't had anything. So
where are we going? Where's the hungry fish?
We're gonna come up here real quick and feed some fish and a very special turtle.
Okay.
So here we have our collection of native fish. So we have a brackish system and a freshwater system. And in this tank, this is our biggest brackish tank. So we have some sea catfish, we have some gaff topsail catfish, drum, and I can hear our little diamondback terrapin coming down this way. So diamondback terrapins live along the coast, over in the delta. There she is. And you can hear, you can always tell when she's ready for food. She sounds to me like a little kid splashing at the side of the pool, because that's what she's doing. She's kind of splashing at the edge of the exhibit, looking for her food. And today she's getting some tilapia fillet, but a lot of times she'll get pieces of shrimp or other cut up fish. This zone tends to be the splash zone.
You know, most people wouldn't necessarily look upon a fish as something that they're going to be fond of.
Well, exactly. And that's one of the things when you come to the zoo, you might not think the fish is going to be something you make a connection with. There's all these, you know, big mammals, you know, things that are cute and fluffy. But we have one fish in particular that we have a special connection with here. His name is Gary. He's an alligator garfish. When we got him, because we do go out and we collect our own fish and we bring them into the zoo, and if they are, you know, fine, there's a little too big for our exhibits, we're allowed by the state to actually release them back out into the wild. When we went to do a collecting trip for our brackish system, it was after some really bad flooding recently, so we're out at Bayou Bienvenue, and it was just way more fresh than it was saltwater out there, and we ended up catching a garfish, and he was the perfect size to start exhibiting, but we weren't expecting him, and he's become very well loved. So we'll go check out Gary. Here he comes. Gary, do you want to come eat?
Gary the garfish is not exactly a critter that's likely to warm your heart.
So he's going to come to the surface.
In fact, this prehistoric-looking fish bears more of a resemblance to the creature from the Black Lagoon than a beloved pet.
They have amazingly wide mouths,
don't they?
As scavengers, they would feed off of anything on the bottom of the waterway that they're living in, so that mouth fits in a lot of stuff. He can sometimes be picky, I will say that. Of all the fish, he is probably the pickiest. Sometimes he really is determined to get a rainbow trout and is not happy with a fillet or a shrimp.
Oh, that's
we do have picky animals.
When you get picky at the zoo, that's quite something.
Right? They know we have a variety, and sometimes if it's not what they want, they'll hold out knowing that we'll almost always give in.
Something tells me it's all happening at the zoo. I do believe it, I do believe it's true.
There's lots more Audubon Zoo animals to visit when Louisiana Eats returns after a short break. Stay tuned.
The monkeys stand for honesty, giraffes are insincere, and the elephants are kindly, but they're dumb. Orangutans are skeptical of changes in their cages.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Rouse's Markets, from Camellia Brand, Beans Done Right, a New Orleans tradition since 1923, and from the Napoleon House, located in the historic New Orleans French Quarter, home of the Pimm's Cup cocktail and the toasted muffalata. Lunch, dinner, and private events at 500 Charter Street. Do you have some Louisiana Eats on your mind? We'd like to hear about it, so we opened a phone line to take your calls. Leave us a message at 504-867-9128 or send us an email to louisianaeats@poppytooker.com. And now, back to Louisiana Eats. Now we return to our culinary tour of the Audubon Zoo. Next up, we visited a voluble band of storks with a whole lot of character and a lot to say.
So the noise that you're hearing is something we've noticed isn't just for when they're feeding. They throw their heads back like that when they're greeting each other, when they're, you know, seeing that there might be getting food, but also when we have these wild black-crowned night herons that just fly into their exhibit hoping they'll get a free meal, they'll do that same vocalization and behavior to try and scare them off.
Where are these storks originally found?
So these Maguari storks are found in Central and South America, and here we have Walter and Lucy. So it took a while.
Oh, they're very happy with this. As we said goodbye to the storks, we braced ourselves to meet a creature with a breathtaking reputation, the boa constrictor.
This is the common boa constrictor. So she's an incredibly large snake. When we work with her, we always have two keepers that go in with her.
She's a large snake and she's a party animal. Huh?
She's definitely a party animal. She has a really cool exhibit. So she generally likes to hang out on the shelves, but she'll come down. She likes to turn on the faucet and get in there and take a little bath, and she'll come down, play on the cot. Snakes aren't given a lot of credit for how smart they are, but they do have great primal instincts. They know what they need to do to survive. And just like what we were talking about with our gators, you know, you can train snakes, you can train large gators. So really, really great things you can do with these guys. You can use these actually as animal ambassadors and be able to take them out if you work with them enough.
Hi, my name is Melinda Chambers. I'm a keeper at the Audubon Zoo, and I'm going to talk to y'all about feeding our vampire bats. So we keep our blood here in our fridge, and it's just bovine blood, so cow blood. We get it from a science supply company out of Texas. It comes in frozen and fresh. We mix it up so that the bats get to rotate between the two. The fresh is really good for them, but it's also important that they are used to the taste of frozen blood. So in case we can't get fresh in, we can feed out that frozen blood so we keep a nice rotation. And we feed our bats out of petri dishes. It's a nice shallow dish that they'll walk up and actually sip the blood out of. And we use large syringes to suck the blood up out of the container and then pour it into the little dishes for them. So the species we have here is called the common vampire bat, and they're found throughout South America, more focused in the northern areas of South America. They roost in caves and dead trees. They're obviously nocturnal, so they're only coming out at night. And they'll come out and seek out cattle, and the way they eat is really interesting. They have very, very sharp front teeth, and their saliva actually has a numbing quality to it, so the prey item has no idea that the bat is even there. They're small and light, and all of those adaptations that I just said allow them to sneak up. They have an anticoagulant in their spit that actually keeps the blood flowing, and they slurp it up like a straw, and then they fly away, and the prey item is none the wiser.
That's an amazing meal.
Yes. Yes, for one of them.
One of the two. Remember that very special tortoise that the zookeepers mentioned earlier? Well, he made a silent cameo on our last stop as we visited some very charming and beautiful alpacas.
Muddy, silly girl. We do have Pico, the red-footed tortoise, in this garden, so just watch your step. Noelle, touch. Good girl.
They're adorable.
They definitely know it too. Definitely a crowd favorite here at the zoo. A really great addition.
Animals and zookeepers of the Audubon Zoo in New Orleans.
Animals from A to Z, you see antelopes are happy. seen a spotted leopard, loose-gerill, an elephant, a crocodile, a wild hyena with a smile. These are just a few you'll see if you come to the zoo with me.
Situated within the Audubon Zoo in New Orleans is the Louisiana Swamp Exhibit, where on February 2nd, a cute and cuddly creature makes his annual weather prediction.
Now, up north, they do traditional Groundhog's Day with a groundhog that predicts the winter weather. But here in New Orleans, we do things a little differently, and we have our Cajun Groundhog's Day with our Nutria T-Boy, who will predict the Mardi Gras season.
For a lot of locals, the appearance of nutrias like T-Boy looking for his shadow is an adorable sight to see. But unlike his northern cousin, Punxsutawney Phil, this orange-toothed mammal isn't native to our state. Imported to Louisiana in the early 1900s for their fur, the fast-breeding nutria took to our marshes like a fish to water, accelerating coastal erosion in the process. We've been combating this interloper in a variety of ways, unsuccessfully, ever since. But one enterprising entrepreneur in Baton Rouge may have come up with the best plan yet. Hansel Harlan looked to man's best friend for the solution.
My name is Hansel Harlan. I'm the president and co-founder of Mars Dog, along with my sister, Venny Harlan.
Well, Hansel, thank you so much for making the time to talk with us today on Louisiana Eats. I am simply fascinated by your business. Marsh Dog is in the business of making dog treats.
That is absolutely right.
How did this business come about?
During college, I was in graduate school in Argentina. It was down there that I first learned that nutria in Louisiana actually came from Argentina. Growing up, I always knew about nutria, but I thought that they were indigenous to Louisiana.
How did they get here?
They were brought in sort of like, you know how people will like farm chinchilla for the fur?
Yes.
Or so this was sort of like that. They imported them in the early 1900s to raise in captivity for their fur. And they ended up getting loose in Louisiana and going into the marshes.
Well, they sure do know how to multiply, don't they?
Absolutely. Well, see, when they were in Argentina, they don't have near the problem with nutria that we have here because their wetlands there aren't coastal wetlands. They're wetlands in the interior. And their size is controlled by the seasons. During the dry seasons, the wetlands can shrink considerably. So the population of nutria, therefore, kept in check by natural elements. Whereas in Louisiana, they've really just stumbled into nirvana. It's a perfect climate all year round, wetlands all year round, and they multiply at just an astronomical rate. And so the real problem with nutria is that they're just voracious herbivores. They do three things, basically. They sleep, have baby nutria, and eat. But they don't only eat just leaves off of plants. They're pretty selective in what they like. So they actually like to pull up the marsh grasses and eat the tender roots. They're very picky about what they like. But that ends up basically denuding large areas of the wetlands. So what had happened from the time that they got in Louisiana in the early 1900s all the way through the late 70s, early 80s, were that the population was kept in check by people that hunted them and harvested them for their furs. There were millions of nutria that were taken every year by trappers and skinned, and the skins were cured and treated, and they were sold all over the United States and all over the world for fashion. But once that stopped, there were no more predators to keep the nutria population in check. So commensurately, their numbers just exploded. So the biologists, when they were looking at all the land that we were losing, identified nutria as one of the culprits and says, look, oh my gosh, the fur industry is gone. These nutria are unchecked. We've got to figure out a way to solve this problem. So they toyed with a number of different solutions. They talked about poisoning them for a while on some of this large scale. They tried to develop industry where they were going to capture them, bring them in, clean them, and try to sell them for human consumption.
Oh, yes. Even Paul Prudhomme got involved in that effort, I recall.
That's exactly right.
Nutria sauce pecan.
The state was investing millions of dollars in the project at the time.
And then in 1998, they actually put a bounty out on the nutria.
And that was the final solution when they realized that people weren't going to eat them. They said, you know what, we give up, we're just going to pay people to go kill them.
So how's that going?
Well, the Department of Wildlife and Fisheries does a great job with the bounty program, the nutria control program. The problem is that it costs an arm and a leg. What they are doing basically every year is they go through and they figure out how many nutria they have to cull. And right now, I think the numbers last time I checked were about 350,000 to 400,000, depending on the year. They can go in and see the population and how fast it's growing, and they know how many they have to kill in order to basically mow the grass. They're not defeating the problem. They're just keeping it in check. And so when you multiply that times the bounty, the costs that are paid out of the bounty program alone are close to $2 million. Each year.
And what are they doing with all those dead nutria?
They just leave them. They just leave them. They kill them, and they cut the tail off, and they bring it back in, and they get collected.
Wow. And how did you make this connection between dog treats and nutria?
Well, we were looking at the numbers involved with the bounty program, and we were thinking, oh my gosh, if there was only some sort of way where we could harness the forces of capitalism in order to help solve an environmental problem, that being coastal erosion. So we said, well, if we could go down and we could contract with the guys who were already going out there and harvesting the nutria and just chopping off the tail, then maybe we could get them to bring in the body and we could have it processed and turn it into some sort of either dog food or dog treat. Because what was happening, actually, the end of the deal is that I had a dog at the time who was having food allergies because there was a problem with a lot of dog food manufacturers, and I don't want to say a problem, but they use grains in dog food manufacturing, and grains are not a part of a dog's natural diet. And so dogs will end up having allergic reactions to corn, soy, or wheat, which is a large filler in a lot of dog foods. When we finally isolated that was the problem with my dog, I started feeding it home-brewed sort of goulash that I was making from turkey meat. Mm. And so at the same time, I'm reading these various stories every month or two about the nutria, and I saw in connection with the state's efforts to market it as for human consumption, they were talking about how similar it was to turkey meat. And I'm like, well, wait a second. If it's like turkey meat and my turkey meat is so good for my dog, why can't I use nutria meat?
So what year was it when you started concocting dog treats, and how did you come up with the recipe?
I guess it's about 5 years ago right now. And what had happened is I started talking to my sister, Venny, who is a huge dog person. She's also a graphic designer. I said, wouldn't this be fun if we could get a company together and we could go down and contract with these guys and get nutria meat and make these dog treats and sell them? And so we talked about it for about 4 or 5 months. And as I was reading the paper one day, and they have a organization, a federal state cooperative entity called the Barataria Terrebonne National Estuary Program. And it's a federal state group that was formed in order to combat particular problems that plague that ecosystem. And so they had a mini grant program where every year they would have a contest. And if you had a really good idea that would help that estuary in some particular way, you would submit an application. And if they liked it, they would give you a grant. So my sister and I said, oh, well, let's submit an application and see what they think. Got together and created a business plan and an application and sent it in, and we won.
That must have been a big turning point.
Well, it's sort of like the dog that's running after the bus, right? and you catch it, and we're like, oh, my gosh, what do we do now? Because they were said, here you go. Here's your money. When are you going to get started? We're like, oh, where do we even start? So that just started us off on a long journey of going down, getting to know the problem, getting to know the trappers, getting to know the fur industry, making contacts, figuring out how this was actually going to be done.
So the two of you all developed the recipe?
Yes, we did. I sort of took the lead on that with my sister adding ideas and using all of our dogs as test rabbits, so to speak.
I bet they didn't mind.
No, not at all. So over the course of about 6 to 9 months, we came up with a working recipe that we had some concepts that we wanted to implement. We wanted to do all of our ingredients from Louisiana. We wanted it as natural as possible. We wanted to keep it preservative-free at the time. We didn't realize that we were really just putting huge obstacles in front of us with every one of these decisions that we made. But we were able to make it work. So we came out with some biscuits at first, and then we segued into some jerky as well.
Now, where are these treats made?
First, they were made at the kitchen at my home. But we quickly outgrew that, and we created a facility here in Baton Rouge. But we've outstripped our capacity there. So we're presently contracting with some manufacturers to try to pick up our production for us.
And where can people find Marsh Dog Treats?
We are in most independent pet stores in Louisiana. We're in 4 or 5 other states right now, and we have internet sales through most all of the states in the country as well as internationally.
Well, congratulations. There's nothing like a homegrown treat. Hansel, do you have any idea how many nutria you're going through now a year to create Marsh Dog Treats?
That is really hard to say exactly. It's in the hundreds of thousands of pounds. I'll tell you, some people have come to us and will sort of question the efficacy of our business project. And they say, well, gosh, what are you guys going to do if you run out of nutria? And we said, well, you know what? That's the whole point. It should be our motto, put us out of business, right? Because if we run out of nutria, then the problem is solved.
Well, Hansel, you have such a wonderful homegrown success story, and I'm so grateful to have the opportunity to share it with all my Louisiana Eats listeners.
Well, thank you very much. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Hansel Harlan of Marsh Dog Treats.
I was in the kitchen. Seamus, that's the dog who's outside. Well, I was in the kitchen. Seamus, my house outside.
Since we were working on a show all about animals, I sent producer and roving reporter Reggie Morris with his dog, rover reporter Whitey Bulger, out into the streets of New Orleans to talk about dogs in bars. Especially since Whitey's known up and down Magazine Street as the quintessential bar dog.
Speak, Whitey. Speak. Come on. Speak. You can do it. Whitey, speak. There you go. Good boy.
Great. This is Reggie. I'm talking with Rebecca Bond.
The name of the establishment is the Rendezvous Tavern, and I am a bartender here.
And it's a dog-friendly bar?
Yes, it is. We're dog-friendly as long as the dogs are friendly, basically.
You recently have a weight requirement, right?
We did. We had a problem with a few of the larger dogs that were coming in. It really wasn't a problem with the dogs. It was more of the owner. So it was an easy way to put a cap on it.
Do you have favorite dogs that come into the bar?
I do. Whitey is one of my favorites because I love his personality. Whitey is my dog, Leroy's brother. Unfortunately, they've never really met since they were separated. And I really also like Shiner and probably Ringo. Those are my other two favorite dogs, but we have others that come in.
Do y'all keep treats behind the bar? Do y'all have water bowls or anything like that for the dogs?
Well, we do have water. We usually have water available to fill up. And we used to have a water bowl, but I think somebody walked off with it once. And I did bring in treats for a while, and then I think they fell behind the bar. I couldn't reach them. I wish there were more dog-friendly bars because I do like
bars that allow good dogs in there. I think that they like to come out and play just like we do.
Whitey, speak.
Okay.
That was producer Reggie Morris and his infamous dog, James Whitey Bulger. Speak, Whitey. Is in the dog food you're feeding your beloved pet every day? Stay tuned, and we'll solve that mystery when we come right back. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Are you podcasting Louisiana Eats yet? If not, it's time to subscribe. Podcast listeners have access to full-length interviews with chefs like Edward Lee, Donald Link, and Michael Galata, along with new material that's never hit the airwaves before. Just visit poppytooker.com to subscribe. And while you're there, check out our new videos by filmmakers Marion Gay and Jonathan Evans. And now, back to Louisiana Eats. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. What is in the dog food you're feeding your beloved pet every day? If Fido gets inexpensive kibble, the answer's not very pretty, but something you should consider. Is the food feed grade or human grade? Feed grade allows for toxins, such as mold-produced mycotoxins that are unacceptable in human-grade foods. See that healthy-sounding meat and bone meal? That frequently comes from the rendering process. Not really a good thing, since that translates as dead animals from farms, ranches, feedlots, marketing barns, animal shelters, and other facilities, along with fats, grease, and other food waste from restaurants and stores. And then there's the chemicals and preservatives. I'm not even going to try to pronounce the common ones, but you wouldn't ingest them. Is propylene glycol, or PG, listed? That's a common moistening agent that's chemically derived from ethylene glycol. Yep, that's antifreeze. I'm not having any of that. Are you? And then, of course, there's all sorts of food colorings added, most of which are carcinogenic. And guess what? They're there to make the food look good to us. Your dog doesn't care about the color of his food. So what's a pet lover to do? Read the label. Look for food using vitamin C or E as natural preservatives. Only buy food made in the USA. And if possible, make sure the ingredients are human grade, although that's rarely listed on a label. Or stay tuned. Coming up next is Brandon Schultz, author of Cooking for Two. That's you and your furry friend.
Every dog will have its day. That's what people used to say. Nowadays it's not the case. There's a fat cat on the place. Cats are where the rats will surely throw down. Listen up, cause I'm telling you the lowdown.
What does it matter? He keeps getting fatter.
Cooking for a household can have its challenges with the ever-growing list of dietary restrictions. Cookbook author Brandon Schultz's challenges are, shall we say, a breed of their own? He cooks for three different species. Brandon co-authored two volumes of recipes called Cooking for Two, one with his cat Lucy and another with his dog Chase, who all enjoy a variety of elaborate meals together. Talking to Brandon, I quickly learned that Lucy is his number one sous chef.
She absolutely is. There's nothing I can get away with in the kitchen without her input. So she's a vital part of my cooking process for me or for her.
So, Brandon, obviously, it sounds like Lucy's the love of your life. How did you all meet? And describe your Lucy to us.
Sure. So Lucy was living with a friend of mine who needed to find a new home for her because her older cat was becoming unsocial, and she'd had the other cat for about 15 years. And so the easier option was to try to find somewhere where Lucy would be happy. So Lucy actually came to my home for an interview, and then she spent a few days with me to see how she would react to the home and to my dog. And she is the most striking cat you've ever seen, and I'm hoping I don't just have a biased opinion. But aside from her piercing green eyes, she has this gold fur that completely covers her stomach. From the back, she appears to be kind of a gray and black striped cat, but underneath all of this is this gold that when the sun or the light hits her, she just glows like a mineral, like a little ball of gold. It's just really striking. So there was no way I was letting Lucy go back home to her other friend once I saw her.
Oh, that's lovely. And how long have you been cooking for her?
I guess before we started the cookbook, we had been together about 3 years. And we've been cooking every day that we've been living together. I cook a lot, and Lucy is very involved in everything I do. So whenever we're in the kitchen, she's inspecting all the produce that I'm about to chop. She is absolutely inspecting any can that I might be opening. And she is incredibly heavily involved in anything I do, and that certainly includes the kitchen, which is her favorite place to be.
And is Chase, your dog, ready for his day in the limelight?
Chase has been born for this. He has thought every day has been his limelight, and he's glad that the rest of the world is catching on. He is about 15 and a half right now, and he did grow up as a street dog in Italy, so he didn't have the healthiest early years. And He has many more years than he has teeth, let's say that.
Well, if he grew up as a street dog in Italy, did he come complete with a penchant for pasta?
A very discerning Italian palate.
Yeah.
I would say he may have if he had grown up in an Italian household, but growing up on the street, he came with a penchant for anything he could eat.
How did you find him in the first place?
Well, I was living in Rome for school in 2004, and I went on a little vacation to the Amalfi Coast with some of my roommates from Rome, and he happened to be there the first night when we arrived, and he was a scraggly, knotted, lumpy mess. But for some reason, I think I was very exhausted and lost all my judgment, so I was petting him. And the next day, he showed up in another part of the Amalfi Coast where we were just touring around, and he kept showing up everywhere we were for a few days. And then on the last night, we were waiting for our bus to take us to the train, and we had about an hour, I guess, and we all decided to go back, get one last cone of gelato, and sit by my favorite fountain, and he happened to be drinking out of the fountain at the time. And I will say that all of my friends I was with were lovely young ladies, and they were all completely taken by this little fairy tale of the dog who followed me around for days and days and ended up at my favorite fountain. So they talked me into adopting him, which at the time seemed against my better judgment, but I guess it's 12 years later now, and I'm quite glad he's here.
Well, and now he's a famous author just like you.
That's right.
I'm curious, now that this is your second book, and we're covering both of the common house pets, dogs and cats, are there things that you can feed one and not the other?
Yes and no. I mean, generally they can eat many of the same things, and the things you're looking out for moderating, like sugars and fats, you want to do for both of them. You want to give them much less of that than you're giving yourself. But there are some differences. A lot of cats can't handle dairy, a lot of adult cats, despite, you know, the stereotype of cats and a saucer full of milk. Dogs don't typically have that problem with dairy. On the other hand, cats also might not be attracted to sweet things in the way that a dog is a little less discerning about what it's eating.
Mm-hmm. What are the most dangerous things that you need to look out for and make sure that your furry friend isn't lapping up?
Yeah, so there are two main considerations here, and one of them is portion control and the other one is ingredients. So for portion control, it's really critical to remember that your cat is incredibly small and needs to eat very little portions, and you're not offending them by only giving them a tiny dish. You're really looking out for them. Fortunately, a cat is not too likely to overeat as a dog might, but you still really want to control how much of everything you're giving them. And the second consideration is ingredients. Chocolate, onion, garlic, spices like cinnamon, these are things that your dog can't handle at all. Too much salt or sugar, which are also things we should keep in mind for ourselves.
That's true.
And too much sugar.
That's true.
But we really want to restrict it for the cat with a much smaller body size and much smaller systems. Nuts and raisins are things you might have around. You might have nuts around for, just on the table before dinner. You want to make sure the cat's not having any of those. And then there are some fruit considerations. You want to stick to the fleshier parts of the fruit and avoid the seeds and anything that's close to a pit if this fruit has a pit in it. But grapes and, like I said, raisins are totally out of the question. And there's some controversy over tomatoes. Some opposite camps that say they're okay and they're not okay. So the best plan is to just avoid them.
I'd also like you to paint me the picture of when it's special meal time, who eats where? Are they both at the table with you? Or how do you situate everyone in the household for a special meal?
Well, first I have to tell you there is another dog in the house. So there are two dogs and Lucy.
Well, you're cooking Lucy for a pack then.
That's correct. We have a pack. Lucy has her own table where she sits and eats, and it's really just like an end table in the dining room. And that started because the dog would eat her food if it was on the ground, so her food had to be elevated. So she has her own table, and the dogs eat in the kitchen, and the people eat in the dining room. So everyone, well, that sounds kind of sad when I say it that way. Everyone's isolated. But it's New York, so it's kind of open floor plan, so we can all see each other.
Oh, well, that's good. Brandon, congratulations on your adorable new book. And please, please, pat Chase for us and give Lucy our best.
Will do.
Brandon Schultz and his cat Lucy and his dog Chase, co-authors of Cooking for Two.
Me and my cat named Dog.
That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Have you missed an episode of Louisiana Eats? Hear today's show or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. If you're not podcasting yet, it's time to subscribe. We've launched an exclusive podcast series, Louisiana Eats Quick Bites, made up of sneak previews of material that hasn't hit the airwaves yet and full-length interviews never heard on the show before. Visit our podcast page at poppytooker.com so you won't miss a single serving of our broadcast or our podcast. And give us a ring on our new committed phone line, 504-867-9128. We'd love to hear from you. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, Camellia Beans, and Rouse's Markets. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau and from Dickie Brennan Steakhouse, a local New Orleans steakhouse serving prime beef and Louisiana Wagyu in New Orleans' French Quarter. Original theme music composed by David Pomerleau and performed by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Sarah Holtz, and Reggie Morris. And to our business manager and social media maven, Maddie Mulladew. come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Don't forget to find our recipes and see what we're up to at poppytooker.com. You can check us out on Instagram and Facebook, too. Louisiana Eats is a production of Poppy Tooker Broadcasting.